Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show. Today, we're going to go so retro. As we look back on Champions League 97-98, Newcastle beating Barcelona and Real Madrid waiting three decades for a European title. Different times. Plus, we're looking ahead with UEFA's new Way Forward for getting the seasons done around the continent. And we'll find out for whom the Inter Totally Cup is already over as Matt Davis-Adams takes on Michael Cox in the quiz. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Wrong Thinking's Morrissey with Every Day is Like Sunday there. But of course, it's something called Thursday today. Ask your folks. Thursday. And it's a new Totally Football Show. And a big hello to Julien Laurent.
Bonjour, Jimbo. Bonjour, everyone.
Bonjour à toi. Hola, Alvaro Romeo.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
Muy bien, gracias.
And de nada.
Hey up, James Horncastle.
Hey up, lad. How are you?
Yeah, all very good. Very good. Wow, it's extraordinary to hear. It's a bit like, I guess, for American audiences, when they heard a Christian Bale first speaking in an English accent after seeing him in Batman. No?
Yes. After 6 weeks of lockdown, I look like Bale in The Machinist right now.
Yeah, that's fair. Could you do a bit more Yorkshire, though?
Aye. I can if you like. It depends.
Are you worried about your hair, James?
I'm more worried about my wife's desire to cut it.
That's what I'm praying about.
Right, put the full stop wherever you want in that sentence, basically.
You have to go full Tim Howard, man.
Yeah. All right, let's get some news then. Still confusion about when football will be resuming the current season, or indeed if. But some pretty positive word coming out of UEFA, who this Tuesday had another of their big video conferences, which ended with them setting out a format for the conclusion of this season. They'd like to have all the respective federations concluding their competitions before the 31st of July so that they can then stage the cups in August, potentially with one-legged quarterfinals and semi-finals. That's a pretty positive stance. How optimistic do you think they're being?
Well, look, I mean, the virus is still in control. Different countries are at different stages of their let's say rate of infection and how they're dealing with the virus. So they can't really talk concretely about when, but they can maybe look at how. And I think as we've seen in their sort of discussions with leagues over recent weeks, I think the priority is to get the league football done and then have European competitions played at the end of that. But you know, as we keep seeing, while their desire is for harmonisation across Europe, so leagues to restart as closely and as aligned as possible, that is very difficult to achieve when leagues are acting on different advice from governments. We've seen what's happened in the Netherlands this week, where they've suggested that there won't be any football until the beginning of September, which again would kind of throw a spanner in UEFA's work. So I think it remains a very complicated situation and very difficult to plan for.
What I found interesting is that for the first time UEFA said that some special cases will be heard regarding participation in European competitions, meaning this that probably they will have to have a plan if the Dutch League or the Belgian League or any other doesn't resume who goes to Europe next season, who plays Champions League, who plays Europa League. Because we cannot forget that countries like Holland or Belgium, they've got a tremendous death rate per million inhabitants. So the virus is well spread over there. And of course, UEFA can only offer guidelines, but it will be the national governments who decide finally whether a competition will be played or not.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, Newcastle news, the ongoing takeover by Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, has hit an obstacle. Outcry, as you might expect, over the Saudis' suitability. What's been the objection here? Is it war crimes, human rights, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
No, James, it's television rights and how they are being devalued by alleged piracy out of Saudi
Arabia.
I think
you could just call it piracy. There's not much alleged about
it. Yeah, it's not alleged. I mean, they call the channel Be Out Q just to take the mick of being sport. I mean, it's genius. Just the name in itself, whether you agree or not with the piracy and, you know, the illegal stream.
Probably not. You probably don't agree with it.
You don't agree.
Well, beIN Sport too are the biggest overseas rights holders of the Premier League, and as such have a certain amount of clout in terms of Premier League matters, have written to all the club owners and the Premier League to urge them to block this takeover because they say that Saudi Arabia are not suitable because they fund BeOutQ, which is a pirate service which illegally shows Premier League matches by essentially running a line off beIN Sport's.
Yes,
service.
Because of the boycott and the blockage between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia have blocked the feed from Qatar to Saudi Arabia. So if you live in Saudi Arabia, you cannot get beIN Sport to watch the Premier League or the Serie A or the Champions League or Ligue 1. And instead, as you said, they funded this illegal stream called BRQ. So then you can watch it on there, which is obviously completely illegal. And you see what beIN Sport are trying to do, and it's probably even more politically and just simply finding an excuse to try to block the Saudis buying a European club more than anything else. But it will be resolved by BeOutQ disappearing and the Qatari not saying anything about the Saudis taking over Newcastle.
All right, Jules, you've been writing about who Newcastle can buy with their new blood-splattered billions. Who have they got on the list?
Yeah, the interest. So there's two sides of it. One is the manager, because if Steve Bruce believes that he has a future at the club, I think he's wrong, and he can only try to book his next holiday, because that's what they
difficult,
do.
That's difficult, Jules.
Yeah, that's difficult. He doesn't know when. But
we aren't going on holiday for a long time.
Soon. Yeah, true. If you look, for example, at when the Qatari took over at PSG, the manager was Antoine Cambrai. He was top of the league at Christmas, and they replaced him by Carlo Ancelotti. Who didn't win the league in the end, but because they wanted a much bigger name than whoever was in place, and it would be the same, unfortunately, for Steve Bruce, like it was the same for Mark Hughes at Manchester City. That's what they do. First of all, it has to be the manager, and then the players.
They came for the manager. Yeah.
Yeah, no, but in terms of manager, they have a very ambitious shortlist in the four names that they've drawn so far. Two are out of a job right now in Max Allegri and Mauricio Pochettino. And then the other two are already in a job. Rafa Benitez, who could come back to Newcastle, who's in China, and Lucien Favre, who is at Borussia Dortmund. So it'd be very interesting to see what happens. And then in terms of players, because of financial fair play, people have to stop believing that they can go out and spend 500 million this summer. That won't happen. But they will still be able to sign big players, especially if they are off contract. That's why so far they've been targeting or looking into targeting players like Dries Mertens, like Edinson Cavani, who are out of contract in the summer, who could be easier for Newcastle to go and get them and still try to balance their book at the end of the season with financial fair play.
In other news, and on a happier note, Barcelona, Alvaro, are going to sell the naming rights to the Camp Nou for the first time ever for a very good cause.
Yes, and it is probably one of the best ideas that Barcelona has had, and definitely this directing board. For the first time in their history, they are going to look for a sponsor to name the stadium, and the money earned will be, during the first season, will be donated to fight coronavirus. It's still to be determined whether it will be Camp Nou plus the sponsor name, or vice versa, sponsor name plus Camp Nou. Josep Vives, the Barcelona spokesman, couldn't answer that question last Tuesday. And this is not exactly like an auction because there is no starting price. So let's see, but it's a very good thing for Barcelona and the first good news in a while as well, because Barcelona was the first team in Spain that furloughed their staff. Six members from the directing board resigned over the last month, and this is clearly something that Barcelona has done right. And when a club does something right, it has to be said.
Okay, Alvaro, you said the money from the first season would go to the fight against coronavirus. Is this, because I'd understood this was a kind of one-off thing, we'll do this for a season to raise money, but is the suggestion that they're actually going to just have sponsorship from now on, but they're kind of introducing it by making it for coronavirus?
Yeah, you could read it like that, obviously, but obviously a company that decides to sponsor Barcelona's Camp Nou from now on not only will be giving money to Barcelona, but will be giving money for coronavirus at least for a year. So this is also a very good PR work for whichever company wants to sponsor Barcelona, and a lot of money, really. Atlético de Madrid is making up to 10 million euro per season for the naming rights of the stadium, and I can imagine that Barcelona signing that contract 4 years after Atletico did with Wanda, and being Barcelona probably a bigger club, they will get more money than Atletico. Definitely they will match the 10 million cap, but I can imagine that 15 or 20 million per year is nothing crazy to think about, and 20 million going to the coronavirus fight, it's very good news.
Impressive sums there, Alvaro. Well, lots of listeners writing in after our last edition, in which we talked about Swedish footballer Elin Ekbom Back, who's also an epidemiologist, which is very impressive. Hannes Waller writes, "I don't think you're giving Elin Ekbom Back enough credit for his post-football career. Not only is he fighting against COVID-19, but he's also been disguised as a woman all this time. Quite the feat, if you ask me." Indeed, Hannes. Apologies for that, Elin, who, of course, is actually female. The clue's rather in the name, but tremendously impressive stuff. This was all part of our discussion of post-football careers.
Do you know what Stéphane Guivarch is doing now?
What's he doing now, Jules?
He's selling swimming pools.
Is he?
And some say he's a much better swimming pool seller than he was a football player.
Is he a World Cup winning swimming pool salesman?
Yeah, exactly. He sells World Cup pools.
That's fantastic. Ellis Midden links that with the quiz from our last show, by mentioning that Sergei Baltacho was his PE teacher at his first secondary school. Sasha Gurionov leaps in and says, "Oh, was that Bacon's College? I play football there." This is Sasha. Sergei is back at Charlton now. He taught Joe Gomez a thing or two about the game. Wow. More on that topic to come. Petters, meanwhile, gets in touch to say, "Loving the ISO pods, guys." Thank you, Petters. "Segment suggestion to replace Flicks and Kicks. How about Ads with Da Lads, where you compare," he continues, "the best football ads of all time and dissect the matchups, lineups, and who would win. For me, it's a final of Nike The Mission," which is that great one with Edgar Davids and the kendo outfit, and Adidas's Road to Lisbon.
Road to Lisbon was before the 04 Euros, obviously.
Yes.
And wasn't it the one where they were on the mopeds? I think they were on those little motorbikes.
It is.
You know, and Zidane, he's at the bottom of Beckham's flat and Beckham throws the ball and Zidane controls it in a very insolent way. And then a few kippy-uppies and then he goes on his moped with his Predators and they go through Paris. And I don't remember how he ends and who else was in there, but I remember Beckham and Zidane were at the beginning of it.
They get to Lisbon, Jules. That's how it ends.
Oh, of course. Yeah. But I don't know who else was in the advert. That's what I meant. Sorry.
There's Ashley Cole, Oliver Kahn, who looks great on a moped.
Right.
And then they kind of get ambushed by the Spaniards, led by Raul. Quite a menacing group of three Spaniards in kind of red mopeds.
It's more menacing in the ad than in the Euros itself, because Spain didn't go through the group stage.
That's very, very true. All right, well, much more on this exciting topic later on. Also, plenty of comment on the quiz. Daniel Barber says the specialist subjects have to be widened for future rounds, in my opinion. The integrity of this great competition has to be protected. Swiss Ramble, meanwhile, hello to you, Mr. Swiss, looking forward to someone choosing a single game for their specialist subject. Well, I think Mr. Ramble and everybody else will be pleasantly surprised, actually, by today's specialist topics, courtesy of today's contestants, Michael Cox and Matt Davis Adams. And in fact, it's time now for those two gentlemen to settle who gets the final quarter-final place with their first-round clash in the Intertotally.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
That's right, listeners, Intertotally Cup, the final first-round matchup, and it's fair to say this is the one that we've all been waiting for. Let's meet the contestants.
Up first, he's the man Owen Coyle once referred to as Zone or Whoever. He literally wrote the book on the history of the Premier League. He's never faced a quiz question he didn't like the look of. He is Michael Dead Parrot Cox.
Wow, Michael, welcome to the Intertotally.
Thank you very much.
A lot of expectations, I have to say. Are you feeling the pressure at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I think Matt's... commentators know a lot about football and they also have to know it off the top of their heads. And shirt numbers is the kind of thing that commentators know very well. I know that's Matt's specialist subject. So, yeah, tough game. But I must say, I was expecting Sasha really to be the strongest contender in this tournament. So whichever one of us goes through, you know, I was expecting to face Sasha. So maybe our path to the final is looking a little bit clearer now.
Right, it's a wide open field. Very briefly, why Dead Parrot?
I've no idea. That's the first time I've heard that. I think okay. It's probably a reference to the quiz team in The Office.
Ah, he said, still not quite understanding. But moving on, here's your challenger.
Opponent. He's a football commentator and so needs this prize money more than literally every other competitor in this quiz. For me, Clive, the voice of the voiceless. Oh my word, it's Matt Davis Adams.
Great intro, Matt. How are you feeling?
We come here with no expectation. Pleased to have been in the draw in the first place. Hugely respectful of the opponent. Just hope to try and have some fun with it.
Downplay. Bit of modestness, downplay. Right, excellent. Matt, what do you need from this first round, do you think?
Realistically, probably three.
At least three.
That's par, I think.
Very probably. All right, there's been a broad variety of specialist subjects so far in the quiz. Let's hear what you've both gone for. Matt?
I have gone for Premier League squad numbers, so broad.
Yeah, certainly sounds it. As for you, Michael, what will you be answering questions on?
I've gone for World Cup 2010, which, I think is broader than some of the other World Cup specialist subjects we've had so far.
Well, there you go. And you're up first, Michael. So here we go with the specialist knowledge round. And question one for you, Michael, on the 2010 World Cup is, which team beat Italy in the group stage to send the holders out?
I think that was Slovakia.
You're correct. Question two. What unusual reason did Diego Maradona give for selecting defender Ariel Garcia in the Argentina squad?
Wow. I really don't know the answer to this one. Unusual reason. The only thing I can remember is that he didn't like fullbacks. So I'm going to say it's something to do with that. But I don't think that's the right answer.
It's a similarly exotic answer. Maradona said that he had a dream that Argentina won the tournament, but Garces was the only face that he could remember from his dream, so he selected him.
Okay. Fair enough.
Question three. Whose effort on goal did Luis Suarez punch off the line in the Uruguay against Ghana quarterfinal?
Wow. Obviously it was Asamoah Gyan who missed the penalty. Just on the basis that he was a striker and might have been shooting, I will say Asamoah Gyan.
You'd be incorrect, Michael. It was Dominic Adeyemi. Question four then, Michael. Which three players appeared in both the Champions League final and the World Cup final in 2010?
So there's Bayern against Inter, so Van Bommel, Wesley Sneijder and... Robin.
That's correct. Question five, then. Four players were joint top scorers in this World Cup competition. Who were they?
One was Sneijder, again, and the others were Villa, Forlan and Thomas Müller.
Correct. A strong finish then gives you 3 points out of five. How do you feel about that score?
Relatively content. The two I got wrong, I definitely wouldn't have known, if that makes
right.
sense. So I'm happy I didn't slip up on anything I'm disappointed with.
Okay, very good. Matt Davis Adams then, getting 3 out of 5 would put you level with Michael Cox as we ask you questions on Premier League squad numbers. Question one, David Beckham had 4 Premier League squad numbers for Manchester United. What were they?
4? He started with number 24. He also had 10 and 7. The fourth one, I am struggling to think of. 7, 24, 10. I don't know is the answer, so let's guess at
22.
Oh, was it 23?
20, no, it's 28. Okay. I have to say that that's a fiendish question.
Yeah.
Okay, then, question two. Referring to the squad numbers from Arsenal's invincible season, if you add Robert Pires to Lauren, then take away Martin Keown, which player's jersey would you get?
Patrick Vieira.
That was so fast.
No, it wasn't, was it? It's,
we
okay,
have to accept
the
answer.
Lauren is two, but he's 12, wasn't he?
He's 12. So now who'd you get, Matt? Robert Pires.
Yeah.
To Lauren.
Yeah.
Then take away Martin Keown.
Henri.
Yeah, that's what you would have got.
Mm. Come close on all of them, haven't I? But it's not going well.
Well, get the next three right and you'll be level with Michael Cox. Question three. Who was Liverpool's number eight before Steven Gerrard?
Øyvind Leonhardsen?
It's incorrect. It's Emil Heskey. Question four, then. Who is the next player in this sequence? Gianluca Vialli, Chris Sutton, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, Bataille Keshman, and...
Steve Sidwell.
On what basis?
They're all Chelsea number nines, and I think Sidwell was just before Khalid Boularus.
What about Hernan Crespo?
Hernan Crespo... Yeah, yeah, because he was before Mourinho, wasn't he?
Yeah. Okay, then, question five, and this does look crucial now, Matt. To which Premier League great does this sequence of squad numbers belong? 24, 22, 18 and 22.
Paul Scholes.
It's correct. So at the end of that round, Matt, you have scored 1 point out of five, but are only 2 points behind Michael Cox. What do you think?
I think that I should have taken my time over the Arsenal one and then we could make a game of it. So I blame myself for that. And the Chelsea one doesn't reflect very well on me either. So it's done a fair bit of damage to my professional reputation so far.
Right. We've seen that a two-point lead in the quiz, as in so many competitions, is not necessarily a guarantee of success. So it's all very much in the balance when we return with the general knowledge round later on. See you then. Wow, 1 out of 5 and 3 out of 5. Not quite the heavyweight clash so far that we were expecting.
When the pressure gets to you, you know, James, when the pressure gets to them, they were supposed to be leaders in their fields, really. Mm. And actually, they collapsed under the pressure. It's a lesson for everyone.
I thought Cox was gone when I listened to his answers. And you only get 3 out of 5. I usually expect 100%. From him, but
110,
Matt,
I would say.
Matt
I
just mean, unable to make it count. What an opportunity. What an opportunity.
Mean, yeah, I think that Matt was handcuffing himself choosing a topic like that. It's too wide.
Indeed so. Well, we're here if they fare better. I'm sure they will. I mean, they have to, right? In the general knowledge round later on. That, though, is at the back end of today's show because next up, it's the latest chapter in our Champions League story. Season 6, 97-98, possibly our most exciting yet.
I'm Jose Mourinho. I know a thing or two about being special. Finding pastel de natas in a London cafe? Special. Winning the daily jackpot on Paddy Power games? Not special.
Understood, Jose. Yes, someone wins an average £40,000 jackpot every single day. So if you win, don't think you're special. Daily Jackpots by Paddy Power Games. Jackpots must be awarded by 11 p.m. and vary from day to day. Jackpot is shared with other operators, available on selected games. T's and C's at paddypower.com. 18+ BeGambleAware.org.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a beautifully simple way to showcase and sell your photography. Picfair is used by over 150,000 people worldwide. It's a free platform that allows anyone to sell their photos, from complete amateurs like me to seasoned professionals, probably like some of you out there in Podland. And Picfair is so simple. All you do is upload your photos, name your price, and those pics will appear on your personal online photography store. Your photographs will also be listed on Picfair's central marketplace, where images taken by people who've never sold a picture before have been published by The Guardian, Time Out and Rough Guides, and they've even been used on the front cover of National Geographic. Alongside digital downloads, customers can also purchase your photos as beautiful frame prints and canvases. And whether you sell them through your own store or the marketplace, Picfair will produce the prints for you in high quality labs and take care of all of the shipping. So if you've got time on your hands and you're wondering what to do with all of the brilliant photos you've got lying around on your hard drive or camera roll, go to picfair.com and sign up for free today. That's PICFAIR.com. Picfair, a new home for your photography. On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Season 6 of the Champions League. In many ways, a turning point. For the first time, non-champions were allowed entry. The likes of Newcastle, Paris Saint-Germain and Parma. There goes the neighbourhood. 97-98 brought so much, though. The return from the east of Lobanovsky's Dynamo Kiev with a young Andrei Shevchenko. Newcastle beating Barcelona. In fact, everybody beating Barcelona. And Real Madrid finally winning their septima, ending their 30 years of Dolores. Let's dive in. El talismán de tu piel me ha dicho
que soy la reina de tus caprichos. Chasing after him, the cross coming in, and it's a good one! It's a hat-trick! A hat-trick for Espria! 3-0! Wonderful stuff from Newcastle!
Opening day of the group stage, Barcelona's visit to St James's Park, cited by many listeners as their season highlight. That red-haired dude says, how on earth did a La Liga-winning Barcelona side featuring Guardiola, Figo, Rivaldo, Stoichkov and Luis Enrique finish bottom of their group with Kiev, PSV and Newcastle?
Well, I think that Barcelona was always better in the second half of the season under Luis Van Gaal, definitely in 97-98 and 98-99. It took a little bit to the players to adapt to Luis Van Gaal's system. That Barcelona was pretty much crafted that summer, doing panic buy-ins to replace Ronaldo, who had left to Inter Milan. So Sonny Anderson was bought. He was not quite Ronaldo, even though he was an all right striker. Then Rivaldo was bought in the deadline day, and it took some time to amalgamate all that talent together. But by the time that Luis Van Gaal managed to do that, it was too late. Barcelona, in November, lost 3 or 4 La Liga games. They also lost a couple of games in Champions League, and that was pretty much their full stop in the Champions League campaign that season, to the point that some in Barcelona were asking for Luis Van Gaal to be sacked in November 1997, because wow. If you check the stats, they are really damning for Barcelona. I mean, Dynamo Kiev scored an aggregate in the group stage against Barcelona of a 7-0 against them. The consequences of all that bad autumn that Barcelona had was that Vitor Baia was loaned out to Porto. Ruud Gesp ended up being Barcelona's goalkeeper. And Barcelona ended up becoming the Barcelona of the Dutch players. Van Gaal signed the De Boer brothers, signed Patrick Kluivert because Sonny Anderson didn't work. And yeah, it was a Barcelona still in formation, to put it some sort of way. And Van Gaal was very clever as well to know that if you cannot beat your rivals, because PSV and Doven was in that group with Barcelona and Dynamo Kiev and Newcastle, if you cannot beat them, you have to buy them. And right. He bought Cocu and Zenden as well from that PSV and Doven. And the season after, Barcelona was a better team.
All right, as for Newcastle, they followed up a good 2-2 draw away in Kiev with 3 consecutive defeats to lose any chance of qualifying. Dynamo Kiev, meanwhile, turned out to be the revelations of the group. As you mentioned, Alvaro, with that extraordinary aggregate 7-0 scoreline over Barcelona, when they beat them in Kiev, I think a lot of people put it down to one of those days. But to then go to the Camp Nou and beat them 4-0 there, hat-trick for Sheva, Rebrov gets the 4th, Tottenham wisely bought Rebrov.
Well, it was a great partnership. I mean, Rebrov has sort of largely been discredited because of his move and his career did not move in the same direction as Shevchenko. Sheva, who would become AC Milan's second all-time top scorer and win the Ballon d'Or. I think he'd be the second player from Kiev, from a Lobanovsky side, to win that award. And I think these 2 years of Dynamo Kiev in this competition, certainly in 98-99, you had the feeling that they could win it. They were put out by Bayern Munich. But watching back the footage of Shevchenko's performance that night, it's not just, again, as Alvaro was mentioning with Tino Spria, the headers that he scores, because he scores two headers and a penalty. but just how much running he was doing on the right-hand side, how many times that a Barcelona player had the ball, thought they had time, was kind of scanning their options and would have the ball taken away from them from Xhaka. It felt that that was a real kind of coming out party, a breakout season for Xhaka in Europe. And again, that this Kiev side could maybe emulate or even do better than the Lobanovsky vintages that won, what, the Cup Winners' Cup in 75 and 86. Because certainly, you know, Rebrov and Shevchenko, they had something really special going on.
How special was this Kiev side with this legendary figure at their helm? Lobanovsky on his third stint with Dynamo Kiev, a man who had won two Cup Winners' Cups with them, then taken Russia to the 88 European Championships final with the Netherlands, a man who also brought computer analysis to football 2 decades before the likes of Sam Allardyce. Jules, how revolutionary was the whole Lobanovsky project?
I think it was. The three stints that he had at the club, the earlier one that James mentioned with blocking and etc. in the 70s, and after that, finishing with that great generation. I do always wonder if he recognised very early that he had a very special generation, and that's why he came back in the 90s as well to go and coach Shevchenko and Rebrov, because he could see that with his philosophy and his idea and that sort of pressing your own half and then going very quickly forward, those players would fit perfectly. And I think that was the key of the success, that he had the squad, one, a very talented squad, and two, a squad that was perfectly fitted for what kind of football he wanted to implement and wanted to play. And I think to come back again at his age and to have those kind of results, like James said, those two Champions League back-to-back, the 97-98, the current one we're looking at, and then the next one, was absolutely phenomenal. And the 97-98 started, if you remember, in Wales against Barry Town in the first qualifying round of the Champions League that year, which is quite incredible. A bit like Ajax did last season. They went through every qualifying round and then into the group stages and etc. But it was just so refreshing, I think, to see them playing the way they did at that time.
Also in the Champions League that year, their only ever appearance in this competition were Parma, who had Carlo Ancelotti as their boss. He turned down, he blocked the club's purchase of Roberto Baggio that summer, and perhaps not uncoincidentally, didn't get out of the group behind Borussia Dortmund, Sparta Prague and Galatasaray. The other Italian team in the Champions League were, of course, Juventus. And once again, they were in a group with Man United. Second year of three that these two teams would face each other. United, as we mentioned, very much taking Juve as a yardstick of their European progress. This time, James, they'd really got the measure of them. Now the drugs don't work, they just make you worse, but I know I'll see your face again. And here's Giggs.
Oh, I don't believe that! That's an astonishing goal!
I think it's quite interesting what Alvaro was saying about Barcelona earlier, because Juve, every summer, from going to one final to another, changed the team. They sold players, they brought in new strikers more often than not. So, for example, Christian Vieri leaves for Atletico Madrid, where he finishes top scorer in La Liga. I think they sell Jugovic as well. And certainly for this game at Old Trafford, which is a great game. Seek it out on YouTube, because it's, I wouldn't say it's end-to-end. I think you get a real sense of the atmosphere, and United just carried by it as well. It didn't look like it was going to go their way again, because Juventus took the lead, what, within a minute through Del Piero. Suspicion of offside. I think this is where Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, became resolute in his belief that Pippo Inzaghi was born offside. United then just dominate have a goal disallowed from Sheringham. Sheringham then scores a towering header. It gets worse for Juve because Didier Deschamps had got sent off, and he was already having to run all over the midfield because Juventus were without Antonio Conte and Angelo Di Livio. So it was a slightly depleted Juventus team. But all the same, it did feel that United were fine after reaching the semi-final the year before, were beginning to acclimate to these big Champions League nights, and would end up winning this group with what I think was the highest points tally in the group stage that year, along with the holders, Borussia Dortmund.
Right. Ryan Giggs, scorer of the final goal that night at Old Trafford with a phenomenal performance in the first leg. Second leg, by this point, Man United were already qualified for the knockout stages and took their foot off the gas, I think it's fair to say, as Juve went through with a 1-0 win, meaning that even though they had the same points as PSG, they took a place in the next round and the Parisians stayed at home, Jules. How about that?
Yeah, they did. Only the two best runners-up were going through anyway. And on goal difference, as you said, they were knocked out. It was a good group stages for PSG in the end. If you look at it, they won four games, lost two. They lost heavily in Munich against Bayern 5-1, but they won 3-1 at the Parc des Princes in the return fixture. The one that cost them is the defeat at Besiktas, where they were, from what I can remember, horrible. It was a horrible performance. They were just not... They never turned up, and I think that would cost them eventually their qualification.
I'm Jose Mourinho. I know a thing or two about being special. Football pundits who actually understand management, special. Winning the daily jackpot on Paddy Power games, not special.
Understood, Jose. Yes, someone wins an average £40,000 jackpot every single day. So if you win, don't think you're special. Daily jackpots by Paddy Power Games. Jackpots must be awarded by 11 p.m. and vary from day to day. Jackpot is shared with other operators. Available on selected games. T's and C's at paddypower.com. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker, and podcast platforms everywhere. This is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Into 1998, then, and the knockout stages. And with the World Cup looming that summer in France, spring was all about Obar Obar and Brazil running roughshod through an airport all over your TV. This, of course, was before there was the no liquids and security measures, when you literally could play football through an X-ray machine and then out onto the tarmac. We'll come onto that advert later on, but I know, James, it's very special for you.
Oh, I love that. I think that's one of the best... if not the best football advert of all time. It got me so excited for the 98 World Cup. And
right.
Yeah, I think for me, and it's good that we're talking about this season, because I think the Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo, was a player who I don't think we'd ever seen anything of his like before in terms of what he could do at speed, with skill. And it was... That for me is the year of Ronaldo for good and bad reasons.
It was the last year we'd seen before the knee blew out. And the same goes for Alessandro Del Piero. Of course, Ronaldo wasn't in the Champions League. He was in the UEFA Cup with Inter. We'll talk a little bit more about what happened in that later on. But knockout rounds then in the Champions League. In the quarterfinals, Juve by now had picked up Edgar Davids from Milan, and they ended Dinamo Kiev's run in front of 100,000 fans at the Olympic Stadion with a super Pippo Inzaghi hat-trick. Man United's run, meanwhile, ended abruptly at the hands of Monaco, Jules. Akbar Chaudhry says, fun fact, the Trezeguet goal at Old Trafford that essentially knocked United out was measured at 96 miles per hour. Pow! They were exciting. Let's talk about that Monaco side.
Yeah, they won the league the year before. That's why they qualified for the Champions League. Sonny Anderson was the big star player at that time in that team. And then, as Alvaro said a bit earlier on the show, he left for Barcelona. And it was the perfect move for Monaco. They were so happy to take that money because, obviously, they had in their reserve team or in the first team, but very young, David Trezeguet and Thierry Henry as well as Victor Ikpeba, the Nigerian international. But it felt like the time more for Trezeguet even than Henry, to have the space finally in the first team and to explode and show all his talent. And that's exactly what Trezeguet did that season. The year before, when they won the league, Anderson had 19 goals in Ligue 1, and Trezeguet had 18 goals in his first season at 19 years of age after Sonny had left. And it was a very interesting team. John Collins, the Scottish player, he was Scottish, wasn't he? Was one of the most experienced player there with Ali Benarbia and players like that. But you had a very, very good group of young players coming through. Henri et Trezeguet, but Julie as well. Martin Jetou was only 22 then, who then went on to play for Parma. You had a very young Philippe Christenval, who was 18 and already making a name for himself back home in that team. So it was a team with a lot of youth and energy and talent everywhere. And those two games against United, the first one he finished 0-0 at the Stade Louis II. And then they were a bit lucky in the second leg because I think United were without Giggs, Keane, I think Pallister as well. And they had a lot of injuries. And Monaco had Trezeguet back for that second leg, and he made a big difference.
Andrew Lang says, I used to raid that Monaco team in Championship Manager 2, 97-98, as my mate kept talking about Terry Henry up front. Back in the, that was before he made that move, which didn't really work out to Juventus, where he was played out on the wing. Juve then picked up Trezeguet, of course, and did rather better with him.
And Trezeguet was really the biggest of the two. He had the best season. Thierry only scored 4 goals in the league that year. He did better in Europe. I think he scored 6 or 7 in Europe. But Trezeguet had a wonderful season that year. And you did wonder why was Juve going for Henry instead of Trezeguet. At that time, Trezeguet was by far the more mature player, the more established, and would have been a better choice for them already then.
Monaco went out in the semi-finals of the competition in another of that season's iconic performances from Juventus, 4-1. Alessandro Del Piero this time with the hat-trick against a hapless.
Well, have you noticed how many hat-tricks we've spoken about today with Asprilla, Shevchenko? Andy Cole scored one against Feyenoord. You then got Inzaghi doing the one at Dinamo Kiev, and then this Del Piero one, which begins with a classic Del Piero free kick.
Barriera forse troppo vicina, parte Del Piero,
ed è gol,
ed è rete, rete fantastica,
incredibile.
Del Piero ancora una volta trova l'incrocio dei pali.
When they signed Trezeguet, they essentially stopped signing other strikers aside from Ibrahimovic. The Del Piero Trezeguet front two, which is I think arguably the best front two Juventus had, because Trezeguet went on to become their all-time top foreign goal scorer, which when you think about some of the players Juventus have had, that's a hell of an achievement. But in this tie, yeah, they get 2 penalties as well.
Yeah, dodgy, a bit dodgy.
But even in the second leg, if I'm not mistaken, they take the lead in that, already having that big advantage from the first one. It's even though Monaco came back in that second leg, it was finished. I must say, I think Juventus in the knockout games, quarterfinal, semi-final, again, they just looked unbeatable. They were just trouncing everyone.
Possibly the most exciting, most free scoring of Lippi's Juve sides. But let's now have a word, Alvaro, about the team that actually won the thing. Who was that, Alvaro?
Mecano, a really popular band in Spain that started in the 80s and went on for a number of years, maybe a decade, and then, like it happens with the big bands, at some point they dissolved.
We've seen it happen so many times. Julien, you were enjoying that.
Yeah, they were big in France. We were talking about it with Alvaro. They were big. They were singing in French. They had a few sort of partnership with French bands and stuff like that. I remember them really well.
All right. El Club de los Humildes. What does that mean, Alvaro?
The Club of the Humble.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about Real Madrid. So Real Madrid had been waiting 32 years in 1998, since the 60s, without a European Cup triumph. Extraordinary thought when you think of how many they've won now. The previous season to this, Fabio Capello had been manager. He won the title with them. And he brought in a whole heap of players, forming the bedrock of this season's European champions, Alvaro.
Yes, absolutely. I think that what happened in summer 1996 explains what happened in May 1998. I mean, the signings that Real Madrid did that summer were key. Petja Mijatovic was signed by Real Madrid and at the time was the most expensive ever player in La Liga. And I think that the song fits in a way the Club of the Humbles, because Real Madrid at that time had a tremendous depth. It was a club that at the time hadn't done the leap into modernity. And I think that it's very telling what Sanchez, Real Madrid captain, said years after winning that Champions League in 1998, that is the most important title in Real Madrid's history. And thinking about it now, I cannot disagree too much, because it was 32 years that Real Madrid they hadn't won the European Cup. It was the first Champions League that they won in Technicolor, to put it in some sort of way. And also, from then, Real Madrid has created a new culture of winning no matter what. And they won 7 Champions League from that point, from 1998 onwards. Now they've got 13. And if you think about it, having won 7 Champions League since 1998 until now, it's a lot. And probably the modern history of Real Madrid is now as prosperous as the old history of Real Madrid is. And what happened in 1998, it's very important for them. I remember that everyone in Spain had the sense and the feeling that Juventus was the favorite for that final. Real Madrid ended fourth in that La Liga campaign. And Jupp Heynckes had admitted to Lorenzo Sanz, the president, that he was devastated because he had lost the control of the locker room at Real Madrid. So Real Madrid didn't reach this final in a really great fashion. But at the same time, if you do the combined 11 of that Juventus and that Real Madrid right now, you will realize that Real Madrid was not the underdog at all. Okay, Juventus have been doing really well in domestically and in European terms as well, but Real Madrid had very good players. And they end up winning the final with the goal of Petja Mijatovic. And I'm delighted that Mijatovic scored the goal in that final, because otherwise he would have gone a little bit overlooked by all of us, because he was a player who never had the chance to sign with Yugoslavia because the Balkans went into war. He was a player that when he arrived in Valencia, he was already 24, 25 years old. He was fantastic. He scored a couple of goals in La Liga from the halfway line playing for Valencia. But it wasn't until he scored the goal with Real Madrid in Amsterdam that he became that legendary player. And I think that he was really good. He got a lot of quality. And the fact that he came
second... Like scoring goals offside.
Not as many as Pipo Inzaghi, James. I think that not as many. But the fact that Petja Mijatovic came second in the Ballon d'Or contest in 1997 tells you a lot about how good he is.
Well, 20th of May 1998, then, at the Amsterdam Arena, which felt pretty futuristic back then. There they were, Real Madrid and Juve, two of Europe's colossi meeting up. Real Madrid, you mentioned comparing the 11. So Real Madrid lined up with Bodo Elna, Sanchez, Panucci, Roberto Carlos, Raul, Hierro, Carambeo, Seydorf, Redondo, Mijatovic and Morientes. Juve's starting lineup was Peruzzi, Torricelli, Montero, Giuliano, Di Livio, Deschamps, Davids, Pesotto, Zidane, Del Piero and Pippo Inzaghi. Right.
I think that we can say that probably Juventus was better trained, better coached than Real Madrid. But at the same time, Real Madrid had a lot of talent, to the point that Raúl had to be casted away to the left flank because Morientes and Mijatovic had to play. So that was the amount of talent that Real Madrid had. And I would like to put a special word on Christian Kagembe, the French guy.
Yes, my man, I was going to say.
Jules knows why.
He's the best player in the knockout stages. He's the best player at Real Madrid.
Jules, he scored 3 goals in the knockout stages to take Real Madrid, not single-handedly, but definitely he got a huge contribution in the run to the final.
Yeah, I mean, he could not really play football, but he could run, and he was just running and running and running, and he was so important to get the ball back and then just giving it to players who could actually play. And he was fantastic. And by the way, he went on to win the World Cup with France the same season, the same summer. Only 9 players in the history of the game have won the Champions League and the World Cup the same season. So really? That's you know, that's really rare.
How many of them are French, Jules?
2. Who is the other one? I mean, we only won the World Cup twice, so it's easy.
Rafael Varane.
Yeah, Varane.
Yes, was going to say Benzema, I don't know why.
No, yeah. Roberto Carlos in 2002 won the World Cup after having won the Champions League. And then Sepp Maier, Breitner, Beckenbauer, Gerd Müller and Schwarzenbeck with Bayern Munich in 1974 and Germany in 1974.
Nice. Okay, well, back in 1998, a bit like the previous year, Juve had been favourites and started off probably the better team. The game remained goalless with your friend Carambeo doing a job, I think it's fair to say, on Zinedine Zidane. Until the 66th minute, when Real took the lead, Roberto Carlos fires one in, the ball bounces off Mark Giuliano, and Petja Mijatovic takes it round Angelo Peruzzi and had the moment that he dreamed of.
Roberto Carlos, Mijatovic! Gol! Ha marcado el Madrid! Ha marcado Mijatovic, minuto 21 de la segunda partida!
And I mean literally dreamed of, because apparently, this is the story afterwards, Fernando Sanz awoke in the middle of the night before the game, having had this dream that Peđa Mijatović was going to score the winner in the final. And he basically tells Mijatović this. Mijatović had also convinced himself that he was going to score, and he'd woken up his roommate, it was Davor Šuker, and said, "We're going to win 1-0 and I'm going to score the winner." Imagine the scenes there in their pyjamas.
There you go. And you should know that Peđa Mijatović had a little bit of a niggling injury before that game, and he didn't tell anybody.
Did he not get checked out by the doctors but swear them to secrecy? Because if Jupp Heynckes found out, he wouldn't have played him.
Okay, I'll rephrase that. He didn't tell the person that mattered.
The manager, right. Real Madrid president Lorenzo Sanz, he was so delighted with the victory that he fired Jupp Heynckes soon afterwards, as is the classic Real Madrid fashion. But it didn't matter because Real Madrid were back. And as you say, Alvaro, the kind of modern era of their Euro dominance, does it start with that game?
Definitely, I would say yes, and it's because Real Madrid broke like a historic barrier that they had been fighting against for many years. That was the time when I think Real Madrid, as I said before, just made a step towards modernity and a step towards what they are now, a club that doesn't necessarily need to do very well to win Champions Leagues. In fact, I was checking before, they have only done the European and domestic double three times out of 13. So this victory was very fitting into the Real Madrid news history. They ended up being fourth in that La Liga campaign, and no matter what, they won Champions League. But they weren't used to that success. And I think that the biggest symbol of that is the fact that Real Madrid didn't have any champagne to prepare for the victory, in case they won the Champions League, and they had to ask for their champagne to Juventus. They got Juventus champagne to celebrate the victory. They weren't just ready, they didn't have that culture of winning. So they were even a bit, little bit, how to put it, naive when it came to celebrations as well.
It was an ugly final. There was 51 fouls in the final in 19 minutes. If you look at the one the following year in 99, they made 21 fouls between United and Bayern Munich. 51, I think, is the highest in the history, it must be the highest in the history of Champions League finals. And it was a very, I thought, aggressive final. Watching it again yesterday, it was just not flowing and fluidity and that kind of football. And yeah, that's what I remembered from it from all those years ago.
Well, didn't matter. Real Madrid got their seventh and they're now on 13. Phenomenal. Before we conclude, I'll look back at 97-98. Let's have a quick word on that season's UEFA Cup, the final of which featured Inter, who were back after their defeat, of course, to Schalke in the previous year's two-legged final, taking on Lazio in what was the fourth all-Italian final of the decade. Now, this was at the Parc des Princes.
I was
Jules,
there.
Were you there?
Yeah, I was there. And
oh, right.
I was on
big Lazio fan, Jules.
Of course, yeah. I was with the Lazio Ultras, you know, in the... I was sat sideways on the pitch, and I was on the side where Ronaldo did his very famous flip-flap by the touchline. If you remember, of course, he scored that lovely double-step-over goal, one-on-one with the keeper. But he also did that incredible piece of skills on the touchline, near the touchline, where he did that flip-flap to dribble past two Lazio players. And I was literally sat right there, or not far from there. And it was seeing Ronaldo live like this was absolutely incredible. He was on that game, he was unplayable. Attenzione Ronaldo, salta anche Marchegiani e mette dentro il 3-0,
ma ha avuto la sensazione che potesse trattarsi di posizione di fuori gioco. Ronaldo is probably the player that has had a bigger impact on me as a football supporter, and I don't think that this is because I was too young. I was already 14 or 15 years old when Ronaldo played in La Liga, and then he went to Serie A, and I think that everyone in Italy can tell you the same thing, that the impact of Ronaldo in that league was tremendous. I mean, he was a player that suddenly started dominating La Liga and Serie A, and the rest of the stars in that domestic tournament seemed to be nobody in comparison to Ronaldo. And I think that Mijatović, for example, was a tremendous player, but he was totally overshadowed by the quality of this Brazilian guy who suddenly started scoring 35, 34 goals per season just for fun. I mean, it was astonishing.
Yeah, I think it's amazing when you listen to any of the kind of Hall of Fame defenders from Serie A in that era. And they all say unanimously that the best striker that they have ever come up against. And we're talking people like, you know, Paolo Maldini, Fabio Cannavaro, Franco Baresi. it's Ronaldo, hands down, because he could beat you for pace. He could beat you with skill. It was something that came so naturally to him, as all of his Inter teammates found out. He trained when he wanted. You know, most of the time he would come in after a night out with Christian Vieri, and he was still the best player they'd ever seen, still the best player in training. So I think this UEFA Cup final in particular, as Jules mentioned, with that double step over, completely bamboozling Luka Marchegiani, is one of the iconic UEFA moments. It's one of the iconic Ronaldo moments, particularly that kind of shot behind Marchegiani's shoulder, where you just see the swaying of kind of Ronaldo's hips. He was unplayable that night. He hit the crossbar as well. Bam Bam Zamorano was unplayable that night as well. Probably got the man of the match. They absolutely floored a very good Lazio side, which was at the beginning of its cycle. Lazio had won the Coppa Italia, I think, the week before. And I spoke to Sven Goran Eriksson, who was the manager, a couple of weeks ago. And Sven said that it showed how, this game particularly showed how immature his Lazio side still were, because they were too delighted to have won their first piece of silverware a week beforehand and weren't mentally ready for this game.
Just later this summer, Ronaldo had another final in the same city, Paris. It didn't work out so well. But this one here, possibly his greatest performance for the Nerazzurri. Was it the best performance you've ever seen by a player live, right in front of your young eyes?
Yeah, 100%. It was really breathtaking. And I think the whole Parc des Princes was watching just Ronaldo through that game. I agree with James that Zamorano was great that day, and collectively Inter was so good, but everybody was just waiting for Ronaldo to touch the ball, because every time he was touching the ball, something was happening. And in that UEFA Cup, he scored 6 goals, but was not the top scorer. Who was the top scorer in the UEFA Cup that year? The swimming pool salesman, Stéphane Guivarch, scored 7 goals, one more than Ronaldo, you see?
And what a World Cup he'd have, Jules.
Exactly. Exactly. Incredible. The swimming pool salesman then went on to win the World Cup as well against Ronaldo in the final. But I was at the Stade de France, so just across the city.
All right. But he never made a Nike advert. Well, that was 97-98 then. I feel like there's loads more stories we could touch on then. And possibly we will. Might be a bit more Ronaldo in a forthcoming Golazzo in the future. Still to come, though, on today's Totally Football Show, we've got the dramatic final of our quiz, Matt against Michael. And after this, a bit more chat about ads. All right, so Perez was asking about the best football ad of all time and mentioning the glorious airport romp that Nike gave us to prepare for the 98 World Cup, which, James, is your favourite, as you mentioned before. Jules, what's your nomination?
My favourite is another Nike advert, is the cage one, when they play 3v3 in the cage with Cantona being the master of ceremony, throwing the ball with his tuxedo, and then the 3v3 going. And actually, I was wondering if you could... There was 8 teams. Oh. One team ended up winning the whole tournament.
Oh, no.
And if you could remember some of those teams, one was called Triple Espresso. He had one Italian player, one Japanese, and one French player.
Who was Totti in it?
Totti in it.
Nakata.
Who was Nakata in it? And then the French one.
The French one.
Are we going to do all 8 teams, Jules?
Yeah, of course. We've got time.
No, Zidane. No. Oh no, he's an Adidas player.
Henri.
Yeah, Henri was in that team. Then you had the one touchables with Van Nistelrooy, Vieira, and Scholes, who beat the Triple Espressos.
Yeah.
The Toros Locos, Saviola, Luis Enrique, and Freddy Ljungberg.
Mm-hmm.
Against the Cerberus, Edgar Davids, Viltord, and Thuram. The Cerberus won. Then the Funk Seol brothers, Denilson, Seol, and Ronaldinho against Os Tornados. Surely you remember Os Tornados.
Yeah, this is all some like coke-addled ad directors kind of fever
dream. I think it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Canon.
Jimbo, listen, Os Tornados.
Concept, in terms of the advert, it didn't work as well as their other ones. It didn't have the iconic moment.
No way, I disagree.
It didn't have the au revoir Cantona moment of the Devils. It didn't have the
Do you remember how he celebrated when they scored? He was like, what a goal! Quel but! He was going mad.
All right.
And Os Torneros, Tornados.
Right, that's your favorite. Are you still going?
Ronaldo, Figo, and Roberto Carlos together in the same like. Three aside.
Alvaro, what's your favorite?
Come on. They won it, by the way.
Okay, the most iconic has to be 1998 Brazil ad, the one that James loves.
Okay,
but
good.
My favorite is the Yoga Bonito series in 2005-2006, ahead of the Germany World Cup. And I remember that they featured different players competing with each other. And there is especially one that I love with Zlatan Ibrahimovic, just confirming the legend that said that he could actually kick a chewing gum.
Keep the uppies with the chewing gum
and then put it back in his mouth. That advert is fantastic.
All right, they're all great adverts, but for me, it was always Write the Future, the extraordinary three-minute opus which they made for the 2010 World Cup.
Yes.
Write the Future, because it had the music, Hocus Pocus by Focus. It was just stuffed with iconic shots. You had Rooney in the caravan with the baked beans. You had Ronaldinho's samba going viral, which they then had to reshoot because he got dropped. So apparently they had to do a reshoot, which I've never seen, with Robinho. A bit of a collector's item, that must be. You also had stuff like Cesc throwing the paper away when Rooney comes back and scores. And above all, you had the Che Cannavaro moment. Che Cannavaro, Che Capitano. Literally, in 3 minutes, it's everything that you're dreaming that a World Cup can be. And it won that year the Golden Lion at Cannes for the best film advert. So, you know, it's not... not just me. Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Iñárritu, of course.
Proper director. Not sure who directed your one, Jules, but...
Eric Cantona himself.
He's the guy who did The Revenant, yeah?
Yes.
And Amores Perros, 21 grams.
I mean, I remember taking my wife to see 21 grams. Oh, my God. Is there a more depressing film to go and see on a date night? I did not read the review. Jesus.
Which is... 21 grams, of course, which is also what the ad director for your one, The Cage, had taken before. Coming up with those.
The Cage was phenomenal. I'm sure listeners will agree with me. I'm sure.
All right.
If you were to play in a team with two other players, Jimbo, for a 3v3 tournament, who would you pick? That's the question. Who would, you could pick anyone you want. Past players, current players.
Right.
Who would
future
you pick?
Players. Okay.
Future but you're player, saying James would be in the team.
Yeah, he would be the captain.
Crikey, who would yours be?
I mean,
be?
Everyone would want Jimbo in their team, but who would he want in his team?
Who would yours be, Jules?
I'd go for Zidane. In a 3v3, you need Zidane. And then I would go for like a tough defender, you know, like Cannavaro or someone like... Oh, Van Dijk. I would pick Van Dijk now and Zidane of those years and me.
And
oh, my God, what a team.
Alvaro, two names from you?
From that time, I will go for JJ Okocha and Zidane.
Okay. James, from you?
Oh, attacking.
I would go with Paolo Montero and Pasquale Bruno, and it'd be called Fight Club.
Break legs.
Fight Club. Nice. Nice. I'm going to leave that there for now, but I'm sure we'll come back to this topic with you, hopefully, soon. But waiting their turn to settle their first-round match, the final first-round match in the Intertotally, are Matt and Michael. So let's get going with that. All right, then. Welcome back to Matt Davis-Adams and Michael Cox.
Hi, James.
Hello.
Hello. The situation, as you probably recall, Michael had a slightly disappointing specialist subject, scoring only 3 points out of five, but was then comforted to see his rival, Matt Davis-Adams, score a meagre one, a paltry point in his specialist subject, which admittedly was the very broad Premier League jersey numbers. So, Matt, you are 2 points behind Michael as we approach the general knowledge round. Can you do it?
Probably not, but we'll give it a go.
It all depends on what Michael does in the general knowledge. You can end this right now, Michael, as you go first with your five questions, beginning thus. What do the following teams have in common? Benfica, Ajax, Steaua Bucharest, Benfica again, Barcelona, Juventus and Liverpool. Do you want the list again?
Yes, please.
Benfica, Ajax, Steaua Bucharest, Benfica again, Barcelona, Juventus and Liverpool. What do those teams all have in common?
I don't know. I'm going to guess they, just on the basis of Liverpool, they won the European Cup the year after they lost the final.
It is a European Cup related answer. They're actually the teams that Milan beat to win their European Cup and Champions League titles.
Fair play. Yep.
Question two. Who scored the Czech Republic's goal in the 1996 European Championship final?
It was a penalty, I think, by Patrick Berger.
It's correct. Question three. PSG have won 7 of the last 8 Ligue 1 titles. Who was the manager in the season when they didn't win it?
So it was Monaco. Oh, sorry, you mean the PSG manager?
Yes. Who was the PSG manager in the season that they didn't win it?
Unai Emery.
Is correct. What do the following players have in common? Peter Beardsley, Andrej Kęczorowskis, Andy Cole, and Owen Hargreaves. What do the following players have in common? Peter Beardsley, Andrej Kęczorowskis, Andy Cole, and Owen Hargreaves.
Have they all played for both Manchester clubs?
It's correct. So you've now taken your total to 6 points out of 9. With the correct answer here, you can put this beyond Matt Davis Adams's reach. So question five. What is the next club in this sequence? Liverpool, Manchester City, Arsenal, Tottenham, Manchester United, and who?
Sorry, go again.
So next club in this sequence, Liverpool, Manchester City, Arsenal, Tottenham, Manchester United, and then who?
I can't work out what that sequence is. I will guess, purely on the basis they're the only big six club not there, I'll guess Chelsea.
Is incorrect. They're actually the last 6 Premier League runners-up, a sextet completed by Liverpool. Okay. Liverpool would have been the last name in that sequence. So, Michael, at the end of your general knowledge round, you have scored 3 out of 5, giving you a total of 6. So, Matt, with 5 correct answers in your general knowledge round, you can pull level and force a tiebreak. Extraordinary pressure.
Yeah, I mean, if it happens, and it's a big if, it's going to go down in the annals of this competition, and let's face it, we could do with a good news story from it, given what's happened in recent weeks.
Enough said. All right then, Matt, here come your general knowledge questions. Question one. Name the only player to score an own goal in a World Cup final.
Oh my goodness me. Okay. Hugo Lloris.
It's incorrect, Matt. It was Mario Mandzukic in 2018.
Oh.
Right. The rest of your questions. Question two. At which club was Jose Mourinho's first managerial job?
Guimarães.
No, it was Benfica. Question three. English teams won the European Cup in 7 out of 8 years between 1977 and 1984. But which team won the one they didn't win? So English teams won 7 out of 8 European Cups between 77 and 84. Who was the interloper? Who was the non-English team breaking up that run?
Ajax.
Hamburg beating Juventus in 1983. Question 4. Which of the following venues did not host a game at Euro 96? Did not host a game. Hillsborough, Goodison Park, St James's Park, Villa Park and Elland Road.
Oh, it's between two. I am going to say Goodison Park.
Is correct.
Yes.
Matt. Yes.
I needed that just for my own well-being.
Some consolation there. And can you add to it as we ask you question five? Who was the Milan manager the last time they won Serie A?
The last time they won Serie A? Carlo Ancelotti?
Was not Carlo Ancelotti. It was Max Allegri.
Oh, he's going to be my second guess as well.
So that's 2 points out of 10 for you, Matt.
Is that the lowest so far?
It is the lowest so far.
Okay.
Carl Anker's now suddenly looking like a genuine contender for a semi-final place. What do you think happened to you two then in that? Were the questions particularly fiendish?
I'm still kicking myself about the Lauren one because I knew that, and right, to a lesser extent, the Crespo one. The rest of them, I just didn't know the answers to. Simple as that.
Right, fair enough. Michael, you're through. Are you happy?
Yeah. That was tough. I thought both sets of questions were really difficult for both players. I think Matt emerges from the competition with more credit than Jack Lang, whose victory last week was a genuine disgrace. So there you go.
Right. Every competition needs a heel. Am I right?
That's true. Yeah, I mean, can I just say, as an independent contractor to any potential employers listening, I do research and stuff when I commentate on games. So I will come to it more prepared than I have done with this one. Please don't disregard me for any future work.
You'll always have a home with us here on Totally Matt. Lovely to speak to you, and we'll see you soon, probably this Sunday, actually, for Monday's Totally Football Show. And, Michael, you go through to that big, big matchup with Karl Anker in the quarterfinals. Hurrah!
Great. Looking forward to it.
I think it's fair to say that was not what we were expecting. A disastrous from Matt Davies Adams. Coxie, meanwhile, the joint lowest qualifier, with his 6 points out of 10 alongside the man he'll be facing in the quarterfinals, conveniently enough, Karl Anker. Of course, Alvaro, Jules and James, you've all taken your place in the next round with 8 out of 10.
I'm scared about Pat Nevin, my next opponent. I mean,
right.
Because he's got, let's put it this way, he has witnessed many of the past seasons that we will be talking about.
Delicately even
alive. Are you just saying he's very old?
Yeah, he's really old. Oh my God, that's not a good start for you.
Wow. You'll have that pinned on the dressing room wall ahead of your clash, which is coming up in Sunday night, Monday morning's Totally Football Show. Alvaro taking on Pat for a place in the semi-finals. The other quarter-finals will be Daniel Story up against you, Julien Laurens.
Yes, big game.
That is going to be huge. Well, James Horncastle, you'll be taking on Emma Saunders beating Jack Lang.
Ooh.
Yep. Lang and I progressing with our astute use of the loophole, which was to let someone else go first on the tiebreaker and then just add one. So who's on the right side of the draw? That's what I want to know. Is it me and Lang now with Anker and Cox qualifying with such poor marks?
Well, you know what, James? You and Lang are on one side of the draw with Cox and Karl Anker. So that's very much the athletic side of the draw. And the other side of the draw has Julien and Daniel Story, who put Rafa out, of course, and Pat and Alvaro. So athletic v non-athletic, that's exciting, isn't it?
Has Rafa Honigstein explained the reasons of his collapse and elimination? Do we know what happened?
It would be the motivation for a kind of Das Reboot-style book. It's very much kind of Honigstein's Euro 2000.
He is the Bertie Vogts of our quiz.
He will pitch the idea very soon.
Looking forward then, Alvaro, to hearing you taking on wizened old Pat Nevin on a Sunday or Monday morning, perhaps, for you, listener. But that's it for today's show. Quick reminder as well, we've got a two-part Golazzo out at the moment, exploring the extraordinary world of the Ultras in Italy, and loads of other great content too, all of which is timeless. That's the great thing about nobody playing any football. Do join us anyway on Sunday night, Monday morning. We'll have Matt and Michael back for that alongside Daniel Story. For now, many thanks to Alvaro, to Julien and to James, and to you, listener, and we'll catch up with you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter, and make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Muddy Knees Media.